Hi, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Stacey.
And this is the Body Smart Podcast.
And today's guest is Calum Gore, who is a scientist and researcher. He's really passionate about cardio health, or cardiac health, I should probably say. Yeah. And just really helping people understand their health in general and reduce their risk of disease. We've got so many questions for you.
Great.
But the first thing I want to ask you is, what's the one thing that you wish everyone knew about their health?
Okay, so it's actually not that they already know it. So people already know what they should be doing. They're willfully ignorant. So they're ignoring this part of their health. We spent so much time and money, the government has spent so much time and money educating the public on heart disease. And yet people think that the heart disease is not going to happen to them. They're going to be the exception, but they're not. Cardiovascular diseases are the biggest killers in the world, in the developed countries. And people just literally sit there and not do nothing about their health. They'll stay big, so they won't try and lose weight. They'll not ignore their blood pressure, which it should not be done. They'll continue to smoke. They'll eat bad food. They won't get their lipids checked. They'll do all these things they absolutely know that these things need to be sorted. And they just do nothing about it, thinking that when they're 65, they get that, you know, they'll get a pain in their chest. They'll be able to go to the doctor and the doctor will be able to sort it all out. And in reality, they should be preventing it when they're 20.
Yeah.
When they're 20?
Yeah, in their 20s. That's when the fatty streaks start to build up.
Really?
In the arteries, yeah.
So it's that young.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's plenty of good doctors out there now, great cardiologists that are saying that we should be preventing atherosclerosis in the 20s.
And how would you prevent it? Like, what is it?
So, again, making sure, I mean, we've obviously spoke already, but about kind of like there are hereditary components to cardiovascular disease. So you can, like elevated lipoprotein A. If you have elevated lipoprotein A, it's an atherogenic molecule. It makes your cholesterol sticker. So even a small amount of cholesterol will cause problems, right? So, and that's an independent risk factor. It doesn't matter if you're in shape or if you've got great blood pressure. That's an independent risk factor. No matter what you do, that's going to be a problem.
And that's genetics.
And that's a genetic, yeah. That's
right.
A genetic.
So it doesn't matter, healthiest person in the world, if you've got that disease, is it a genetic disease?
Or? It's just a gene that produces a little bit more lipoprotein than most other people.
And how would you test for even knowing?
So you can actually just test lipoprotein A. You'd only need to do it once, because if you've got elevated lipoprotein A, you've got elevated lipoprotein A. There's not actually any medical treatment currently for lipoprotein A. There are some great trials that should be done around about 2025. And we know that the medicine that's been produced will reduce LPA, lipoprotein A. But what we don't know is that having an effect on the mortality?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to find that out first before we start giving it to everybody.
Yeah.
But the current strategy for lipoprotein A is to make sure that you decrease your LDL. So you go on statins.
So your low-density...
Your low-density lipoprotein.
And your cholesterol. Yeah. What people would generally call cholesterol.
Yeah, well, lipoproteins are the transporters of cholesterol. So that's how you transport... HDL, high-density lipoproteins, is considered good cholesterol because it transports cholesterol from the body to the liver, and LDL cholesterol is considered bad cholesterol because it transports from the liver to the body. So that's kind of like where it's at. And the LDL, it needs to be 100, probably needs to be between 1.4 and 2. That's where you want your LDL if you've got elevated lipoprotein A. And there's obviously other cardiovascular risk factors when it comes to genes. So when we mapped the human genome and then we started doing these genome-wide associated studies, we thought that we're going to glick cardiovascular diseases. We thought we're going to find them genes and we're going to be able to, and it's not worked out like that, because it's actually multiple genes that have small effects that cause cardiovascular disease. Yeah. So it's actually called a polygenic risk score, and it just measures how many gene variants that you've got that have been associated with cardiovascular disease. So, but we can't really do nothing about that. So there is, you're absolutely right, Jamie, there is cardiovascular risk factors that are genetic that you inherit. But, and I think it's about, you can have up to 60% of coronary artery disease can be hereditary.
60% is hereditary.
But then the other part is that you can change your risk factor by 44, you can change your risk of coronary artery disease by 44% if you get your lifestyle sorted.
If you've got that genetic risk factor, you still have quite a big
You still have a
control.
Good proportion, a good control of it. So what we mean by modifiable risk is obviously maintaining a healthy weight. So the BMI is, I hear you hear lots of personal trainers say, BMI is not relevant. BMI is absolutely relevant because not everybody is Arnold Schwarzenegger. So when you talk to a lot of personal trainers, like, I don't use BMI, it's no good because they've got lots of muscle mass. So it isn't relevant for them, but they're the exception. For general mass, BMI is a very, very good tool to use.
We say that a lot. Like BMI for general population is actually a pretty good tool.
Great.
You might have the odd outliers. And if you were to say like, oh, I'm actually like really muscular, maybe you might tip into like 26. Like, but I don't really see anyone who's 27, 27.5, who's not probably carrying excess weight, you know what I mean, in terms of BMI. So it is still, I think I'm like 25.6, I'm like slightly over, but I would also say I'm not like, probably carry more muscle than the average person as well. There's a part of that too, but like you're still on the cusp, you know what I mean, versus, I don't know if it's body positivity movement or body shapes and all sizes, but like if you are, for like most people, like over 25, over 26 BMI, like there is health repercussions to that.
Absolutely is. And one of them health repercussions is we know BMI is positively associated with blood pressure.
Right.
Or blood pressure is positively associated with BMI. So the higher your BMI, the higher your blood pressure.
Yeah. Mm. Can you explain why high blood pressure is an issue? Because it's one of those vague concepts that gets bandied around, like, we know it's bad, but I don't think most people actually understand why it's bad.
Right, so blood pressure is, again, a modifiable risk factor. So we can reduce our blood pressure, we can maintain a healthy blood pressure. So why it's bad is it exerts pressure against the arteries and damages the arteries. That's what it's doing. And that allows atherosclerosis to build up.
And what's atherosclerosis?
Atherosclerosis is basically the build up of plaque in the arteries or the hardening of the arteries, making them thicker and harder. And then that
becomes... Can you reverse that?
Yes. People are going to not like this, but some doctors might not like this. You can see... can I tell my own story on this bit?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, this is a very good point. So in 2016, I learned... Is that the right term? Learned? I found out that my maternal grandfather died of... We didn't know them, strained family members. Died at 40 years old. It was actually... He died the year of my birth. We didn't know that until 2016. And it was off of a major heart attack. So that's me being into cardiovascular science as a researcher. I was like, yeah, okay, now I need to find out why. So I did some tests and lo and behold, I found out that I have elevated lipoprotein A, which is that atherogenic molecule I was telling you about at the start. And what happened was I found out I had that and I thought, well, I'm going to have a CT angiogram. And it's like a CT scan of X-ray of your heart, basically. And I found that I had a small, I think it's like a 25% atheroma, plaque buildup in my LAD, my left anterior descending artery. And you do not want a plaque buildup there because if you get a heart attack in the LAD, it's affectionately known as the widowmaker. It is catastrophic. It is bad.
Why so bad?
Because it supplies the front part, the whole front part of the heart with blood. Mm-hmm. So it's an artery that supplies the front part of the heart. So it's supplying all this here, and it, in particular, it supplies the ventricles.
So can you show the ventricles?
Yeah, so the ventricles are here, the bottom part of the heart, and these are the atria.
So what do the ventricles do?
The ventricles pump out the blood. All right, so they're the main. Mm-hmm. So you've got the left ventricle which pumps out oxygenated blood, and then you've got the right ventricle that pumps out deoxygenated blood, carbon dioxide. And then you got the atria there. So, with the ventricles, so where I had my atheroma, you can't really see it very well. You should have had a bigger one. Yeah. I'm joking. So where I actually had it was, where I've got this atheroma.
So you still have it now?
Yeah, so it's reduced in size. So this is to James' question. Mm-hmm. Is actually right at the bottom part, in the diagonal kind of diagonal arteries off that bottom of the LAD. So it's so deep down in the LAD that the cardiologist that I see said, you might not even feel it if you ever had an heart attack there, because it's just that's where it is.
Yeah.
I started taking a statin, 20 milligrams of rosuvastatin. And the particular problem with this in 2016 is that it was vulnerable. So it was, and most people don't understand this. It's not a complete occlusion of the arteries that causes most heart attacks. It's actually a rupture of an atheroma that could be at 20 to 50%, and it immediately makes blood clot and it occludes the artery by 100%.
So it's not the actual plaque that causes the problem. The plaque, when it's just living there,
if the plaque's
on the
there,
edges.
Yeah, if the plaque's there.
Right.
If it, obviously, if the plaque gets to the point where it is like 90, 95%, it's going to cause a big problem.
Yeah.
But most heart attacks are actually caused by the rupture of a plaque that's vulnerable, soft.
Right.
And you want to harden that. And that's what statins will do, like especially rosuvastatin. It's very good at doing that. And it hardens that plaque.
So it does, the statins don't get rid of the plaque, they just harden the plaque?
They harden it, and they can, yes. So rosuvastatin and atorvastatin have shown that they can reduce the volume of the plaque by about 9%, I think.
Wow. So it's not very much, really.
It is, yeah.
9%?
Yeah, 9% is still a lot. So mine went to 60, like, well, mine went to under 20%.
But it's not something that people can think, oh, well, I'll just do what I do and then I'll take statins and it'll be fine.
Yeah, so you still got, well, for me, yes, the statin actually makes my risk very, very low. But that's because also, so the next part is, so you've got other modifiable risks. So we've talked about, obviously, we've talked about, can you reduce the plaque volume? You can.
Yeah.
You can reduce it with a statin. And even if you don't do nothing else, statins will save you. They will help. Even if you don't modify any of your other risks, we know that. However, it's not going to save you for very long. You still got to modify your other risks. Mm-hmm. So this is where I actually say to people, what you really need to be aware of is your triglycerides. Triglycerides are fat. We make them with excess calories. So if we've got too many calories, we'll convert that into triglycerides. And they get taken around the body in low-density lipoproteins as well, LDL. If you've got too much LDL, you're going to displace the cholesterol from the LDL and you're going to put more triglycerides so you can move that triglyceride around. So normally in an LDL particle, you'll have 80% cholesterol and 20% triglycerides. The more triglycerides you've got, the more displacement of cholesterol you'll have in the LDL. So then you have to guess what? You have to make more LDL cholesterol. Mm. You make smaller LDL, and then that becomes, that's called discordance between, well, there's another atherogenic compound we've not talked about. Now. It's called apolipoprotein B, which again is atherogenic, which just means it's plaque promoting, right? Mm. It's going to cause a plaque. It can cause plaque. So when you start making, so your triglycerides go up, it starts displacing the cholesterol, you'll start to make more cholesterol so you can move the displaced cholesterol around, and then you make more apo, because you're making more LDL, you make more apoB, so you've got a really atherogenic problem. You're in
and
trouble.
Those triglycerides, is that because people are eating a diet high in fat, or is that just in calories?
Both. In calories, yeah, it can be, they could eat high fat, high sugar.
But so somebody could follow a low-fat diet but still have this problem?
Yeah, if they're eating too many calories, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because I think that's a really important takeaway point when people
if
think...
You're eating, it's the only thing to do. So if you eat too many calories, normally what will happen with this, and this is what the body wants to do, is if you eat too many calories, you're going to package that triglyceride into an LDL or a very low-density lipoprotein, and then it's going to get carried away to an adipocyte and be chucked
which
in there.
Which is a fat cell.
Which is a fat cell, and it'll be chucked in there.
Yeah. Right. So basically, it doesn't matter what energy source you eat your calories from, your body is going to convert that. If it's more than you need to use in the moment, it's going to convert that into a triglyceride and then transport it into your fat cells.
And that's a part of that metabolic syndrome where your triglycerides are elevated. And even if you've got somebody on a statin, but their triglycerides are elevated and their LDL is still low, they're still going to have a discordance between apolipoprotein B and LDL. So you're going to have problems. So that's why we know that.
Yeah.
People that have heart attacks, a lot of them have normal cholesterol. They'll be below 5.6 total cholesterol. They'll have below 3 on their LDL, yet they're still having heart attacks. And that's because the triglycerides are displacing the cholesterol, and the cholesterol has to be moved around, and you get the discordance between ApoB and the cholesterol. That's the biggest problem.
Is that because we started with high blood pressure? That's weight, very much weight related.
Yeah. So they're all different risk factors, but they're all kind of interlinked, right? Mm. So you've got high BMI, so you're eating a high calorie diet, right? Because your BMI is high, you've got excess weight. That's caused by high calorie diet. That increases your blood pressure. It increases your triglycerides. That's an issue. Just straight away, there you can sort of solve a massive risk for your heart disease.
So you would say then, it sounds like the one thing people could make a quick change or like a sensible change would be just get that BMI down.
Yeah, get the BMI down. Absolutely. Get your lipids checked. Go to your doctor, get your lipids checked as soon as possible. Don't wait till you're 40. Go now.
That's a big thing, isn't it? Like, yeah. I mean, what is it in the UK where you can go and get your bloods done? Is it?
Yeah.
I
don't know. Or is that when you get like a health check?
Yeah, or like in your 50s and 60s is another one, isn't
it? Yeah. I think you get them every 10 years, maybe. I can't remember. I just tell everybody you should be having your lipids done every year.
Yeah.
Every year, just get them done because you want to make sure that triglycerides stay under 1.7. Probably you want them around about 1.2 to 1. You want your triglycerides at. Then you want your LDL below 3, absolutely. And you want your total cholesterol not to be too elevated. If you achieve that, I think your risk, and you get your BMI sorted, so healthy BMI, and you've got your blood pressure sorted, I think your risk is fairly low.
Yeah. So here's a question then. What if you're high BMI, but you're very active? So you're consuming, maybe you've put the weight on, but you're maintaining your weight. So you're not necessarily eating a higher calorie diet than you need just now.
You're maintaining weight. Yeah, it's a good question. Exercise does help with cholesterol levels. Absolutely. It all depends on that triglyceride count, I should imagine, the risk. I'd like to see the triglycerides get down. It's a good question.
So if you've got somebody who is in a higher BMI, but they bring in exercise, they're managing their diet to at least be at maintenance, and they're eating a healthy diet.
These people, their risk will be lower than somebody else that's not exercising.
Okay.
Is it called, Sam, might even be able to check, is it the Harvard alumni study where it basically says that if you're a healthy weight but you don't exercise, versus that you are overweight but you do exercise, the person who exercises will statistically outlive the person who doesn't because they're exercising on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. We know for with solid evidence that people that exercise. And exercise...
why is that from a health standpoint? Why is exercise like just so fundamentally important to
health? So what you have is there's been a lot of good research in the last, decade. So Herman Ponzer brought out a research study in 2012 that shown that metabolism is constrained. So what he did is he went over to Africa, studied a hunter-gatherer tribe called the Hadzia, and he found out that, and he compared them with Western counterparts, and he did, what he used in the study was the double water-labeled method. So it's the gold standard for
measuring calories.
Measuring energy expenditure. Yeah. Gives them two isotopes, makes them drink, and measures the isotopes. And it's really, really accurate. And he found out that the males were 2,600 calories and the women were 1,900 calories. And it was very, very similar energy expenditure to Western counterparts. And these Hadzia tribe were massively active. They were five hours a day they was active for. And that research came out in 2012. I remember reading that research and then sending it to people because it was very, very good.
And so they were eating probably similar amounts to, like, I would eat 1,900 calories, but I am not running around gathering my food or looking after animals or whatever for 5 hours a day.
No, you're not. So what we know is this is the important point. So I want to get to the point of why exercise is it. I'm trying to work through why exercise is important. What we know is the metabolism adapts very quickly. So there was another study that shown, and it was very small, unfortunately it was small because you don't have many athletes that do this, but it was only in 7 marathon runners. And when I talk about marathon runners, I'm talking about the guys, they followed these guys that did, I think it was 117 marathons in 140 days in the US.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of marathons. And what they seen with these, they didn't do the double water label method. They used a carbon dioxide exchange ratio, I think it was. And what they seen was the metabolism in the first 2 to 4 weeks went up like this. So the first 2 weeks went up. And then ended in the following 2 weeks, it dipped down a little bit and then plateaued. And the upper limit of energy expenditure that they could get was 2.5 times their basal metabolic rate. So we know it adapts, right? You don't just continue exercising and burn. Mm. What happens is, and this is, so why is the Hadzia tribe, the modern day hunter-gatherers, why are they got similar energy expenditure? because that metabolism adapts. And the most likely theory at the moment is that we're diverting energy from other internal processes, such as the immune system. So you notice how athletes always sometimes get a cold and cough that they, you know, they can't get rid of it, they can't shake it, because their immune system is depleted. And we know if...
it's not just because they're taxing their nervous system by just intense exercise all the time.
Yeah, and the metabolism goes, well, I need more energy. We don't need... We'll divert it from the immune system. Mm. They'll also divert it from the reproductive, so the hormones as well.
Yeah.
And this is where it comes to the important point. We know that people that exercise and have that divert, you know, it's very, very good for reproductive health. Reproductive cancers are lower in people that exercise. And we know that if you exercise, you have a decrease in inflammation because it's probably taking that energy away from the immune system, so it's not on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
and it's like, bad for your immune system to be on all the time.
Yeah, I think too much exercise is going to obviously be bad.
Yeah,
if you're working too hard. But then again, I think once your metabolism adjusts and your body adjusts to it, I think you're okay.
That is like a lot of people who do low-intensity, steady-state cardio, they don't actually realize, like, say you the first couple of times you do it, you'll burn a certain amount of calories, but if you keep doing the same exercise, over time your body just adjusts and adapts fast and you don't
burn. You just become more efficient.
Yeah, you just become more efficient and don't burn as many calories.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not just that, I mean, like, if you look at the... I mean, we got on a treadmill and we believe the number on the treadmill, that's how many calories we have. And there's been studies that have shown that we put these people on a treadmill. We blinded how many calories, how many they couldn't see how many calories they were burning. And then you ask them, how many calories do you think they burn? And they way overestimated it.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, I burnt 600. In reality, you burnt 200.
Yeah, and this is the problem with smartwatches as well, though. We get so many clients saying, oh, but my smartwatch says that I've burnt 2,600 calories today, including my BMR. Why am I only supposed to eat, like, 1,500? But that's not necessarily what they've actually burned.
No, it's not. And I don't think a lot of people, when they start on a diet, really understand the calorie deficit. They say there were most people I talk to about the calorie deficit, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm in a calorie deficit. I'm not losing weight, though. Well, then you're not really in a calorie deficit yet.
Mm.
Yeah, because you're overestimating with the watches. You're overestimating with what you're doing on the treadmills and in your exercise. Also, you've got like a 20% variation in calories on food label.
Packaging, which a lot of people don't realise. Yeah. So
you've got to kind of go, right, if you're not in a if you're not losing weight, you're not in a calorie deficit. And if you're not in a calorie deficit, you just need to eat less. 100 calories, just go for another 100 calories. If you think that you're in a 500 calorie deficit, you're not, if you're not losing weight. And what do you know, I read this years ago in the Times, and it was the best thing I read. It's just a doctor saying that how he, it's just like a GP, how he helps his client, how he helps a patient to lose weight. He said, I'll get on the scale. If I don't weigh less, I eat less. Simple as that. I just get on the scale and every day. If I don't weigh a little less, I eat less that day. Until I hit that calorie deficit.
Yeah.
It is funny because there's that age old thing of like, oh, if you had an overweight dog, would you put them on keto? No, you just give them a bit less biscuits and take them for a longer walk. But when we try and apply it to ourselves, we don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, we massively overcomplicate it.
Yeah. But to come back to the point about, you know, obesity and the risk factors, we are saying then that if you were to just tackle at least the exercise to start you off, that's going to be a massive benefit for your risk factors.
Yeah.
Because that, I think for a lot of people, the idea of tackling, right, I've got to get my nutrition in check, I've got to start exercising, I've got to stop eating fast food, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. It's all too much.
Yeah.
So if you could just start with the exercise.
And it's something I actually... advocate as well. I think people should either start the exercise or start the nutrition. I don't think you should do too much. I don't think you're spot on. I think if you do too much, it's just especially with trying to get through to people how they should be eating and moving today, because it's then they're not doing it. And I think once you've done, say, I don't know 6 to 8 weeks of exercise, you can start to then add in better nutrition more advice.
Yeah. And also, exercise is less of a complex thing to learn, isn't it? When we think about learning how to improve your nutrition, it's, well, I've got to think about the calories, I've got to think about more whole foods, I've got to get more protein. Like, there's a lot Whereas if you say to someone, well, actually, I just want you to start walking every day and maybe go to the gym 3 times a week.
Yeah.
That's all you have to learn. That's all you have to do. It's a lot less complex to get your head around.
And it makes you feel really good.
Yes.
It does. Yeah, you get like a really big positive feedback loop from
your
start positive to exercise. Yeah. And then you think, okay, I could do the nutrition.
Yeah.
I actually think exercise should be the first thing. And you, the metabolism adapts, so you're going to get that. So they'll actually lose a little bit of weight because they're going to be expending a little bit more. But I just still think it's more, when you want to lose weight, it's more about calories in or how many calories you're not eating. It's not just about, it's not more, I don't really go on calorie expenditure.
But you can't outrun a bad diet. That's what
you
say.
No, you can't outrun, you cannot. And that's what the Ponzer research shows. You can't outrun a bad diet. You have to hit that calorie deficit. And it's more about the calories in part of the equation. When you're looking at calories in, calories out, the calories in are the most important part of that equation.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is you don't want to end up in a situation where your metabolism adapts and you've got to the point you're running an hour a day, but your metabolism's adapted. So you've now got to run an hour and a half a day and then 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's just not realistic.
It's not.
Well, people haven't got time for it either.
Yeah, it's right. So your metabolism's adapted after 6 to 8 weeks and you've gone through that part of the exercise where your appetite hormones are a little bit more elevated because, you know, you're expending more energy. So you're a little bit more hungry, you know. That's all passed, and then you can really start dealing with the nutrition.
Yeah. And with the research around, you know, the benefits of exercise on these risk factors, is there a preference to cardio-type exercise, or does weight training have the same effect?
Cardiovascular exercise is anything that gets your heart pumping, right? So it can be weight training, as long as it's
moderately intense.
Would that be something that you'd measure by like a heart rate monitor, or is that just like a feeling of I feel a bit out of puff?
I mean, it depends how complex you want to get. So you've got rate, you can just do rate of perceived rate of, you know, your perception of it, RPE as they call it, or you could get a heart rate monitor and work out your zones if you wanted to.
Because I know if I do workout with weights, I will feel like my heart is pumping and I'm like breathing heavily, but if I look on a heart, like on my watch, it's not that high. It might be like 100, 110.
But these watches can be inaccurate.
It can be off. Yeah, but if you do like a heavy set though, if you go and working in like an RPE 8, 9, sort of 10, like my heart rate hits like peak when I'm lifting like heavy weights.
Just wimp out too much.
Why? Yeah, I think if you are lifting heavy weights, it's almost like complete exertion. Like my heart rate goes through the roof.
Yeah.
And it's like I see the big spikes when I'm doing that on like the sort of last two sets of an exercise.
Yeah. But what we're saying is that it doesn't necessarily have to be running
It doesn't have to be running, cycling. It could be anything. The best exercise is the exercise that the person enjoys. If they're enjoying it, they're going to stick to it. But they've got to find an appreciation. And people should try different things as well.
Yep.
You know, they don't go, I do enjoy running. I love running.
Mm.
But I've picked up jiu-jitsu. That's exercising. That's new exercise for me.
Yeah.
So you've got to kind of sometimes come out. As much as, yes, you do want your exercise to be enjoyable, but you've also got to come out of your comfort zone to try out and enjoy new things.
Interesting we talked about that on another episode, didn't we?
Yeah, it's just like people are scared to be beginners nowadays and go and try something new and actually...
They are scared to be beginners. Yeah, that's a good saying. That's exactly right.
But you need to embrace... And you know what the irony of it is? Like being a beginner is actually... Even though it is uncomfortable in the beginning, it's actually where you see the most progress. Like the first year of doing, you know, jiu-jitsu or the first 2 years, you'll see more progress. Then when you start to get to like a purple belt... brown belt, you're just rehearsing all the stuff you already know just to get better and better and better and better. And it's the same like when you start lifting weights, you make so much progress in terms of strength and muscle gain in the first year or two.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's
diminishing. It can be diminishing.
Yeah, so it's...
I mean, Luke said this to me quite well. Yeah, he said, look, white belt's the best belt in jiu-jitsu because there's no expectations.
Yeah.
Right, so if you tap someone out, great. If you get tapped out, you're a white belt, you're a beginner.
You're learning.
Yeah. So I've been running with that. I'm like, yeah, well, you're a purple belt. You should be tapping me.
Are you ready to lose 30 to 60 pounds in under 6 months without restrictive diets, countless hours exercising, or any guesswork? Well, we help women over 30 do exactly that. Lose weight guaranteed. And 5 to 10 pounds a month is the average weight loss. And that's not a cherry pick statistic, that is the average. Your weight loss results are 100% guaranteed. You will lose unwanted body fat. So apply at bodysmartfitness.com. That's bodysmartfitness.com, but only if you're a woman over 30 and want to lose 30 to 60 pounds.
So we've covered then that exercise is obviously really good for the triglycerides because you're then using up the energy. You're not just going to have as much spare energy running around.
Yeah, in essence, yeah.
What about for blood pressure? Because it is shown blood to pressure, reduce blood pressure.
Absolutely, yeah. Would you say I've got high blood pressure?
Yeah, you do.
So I've got high blood pressure, like typically it's been around 140 over 80. And I think what would be, I guess maybe like for some of our audience, they might be shocked by that because I guess I'm slightly overweight on BMI, but I'm a healthy weight, body fat percentage. Exercise 5 to 7 times a week. Eat a healthy diet. I get pretty decent sleep, I would say. I don't get like horrendous sleep. I probably don't manage my stress the best that I could. That's probably the next one. But on paper, everything else, you'd say I'm healthy. Yeah. And then when I put this blood pressure machine on my arm, and I've kind of known this for about 2 years, and that's been the thing as well. Like I feel great, fine. I have good energy, good cognition. I don't feel bad in any way. And that's why they say high blood pressure is the silent killer, in the sense of like, you don't know, do you? So now of this year.
That is right, yeah.
Yeah, I've made a real conscious effort and it is high. And it even goes, as I've been speaking with you, when I travel, it goes even higher. It goes like 150 over 90 versus it's normally around 140 over 80. And it's on its way down now, which is obviously good. To see more in the 130s over 70, and you want to get me to around 115 over 75.
I think the best number for blood pressure, we all know, well, anyone that's involved in health will know that 120 over 80 is the sum that you want. That's the readings that you want, 120 over 80. But there's some good research that suggests that it should be about 110 over 75. That's the ideal, that's the optimal. And when we looked at, when researchers looked at two tribes in the Amazon. One tribe was westernized, so they had western parts of the diet, in particular salt. And then the other part, the other tribe weren't. They were not part. They were still traditional hunter gatherers, and it kind of changed the paradigm of thinking that blood pressure increases with age. With this tribe, it didn't. It didn't increase with age. It stayed the same. The rankings stayed the same. So that's interesting. So blood pressure doesn't actually increase with age in hunter-gatherers that are not been exposed to salt.
And maybe aren't becoming ever more sedentary as they age.
Yeah, sedentary as they age as well. So, the big takeaway point from that study was they were excreting less than, I think it was 1 millimoles per 24 hours in this hunter-gatherer tribe in the Amazon. Their blood pressure didn't increase with age, and it was 90 over 60 readings.
Wow.
Right? And then the westernized hunter-gatherer, the westernized natives, they had salt in their diet. They excreted about 40 to 220 millimoles per 24 hours, and they had high blood pressure, and it increased with age. So I think the best... From some of the research that I've been reading, probably the best reading for blood pressure is 110 over 75. And another interesting fact that I was reading the other day was that, I don't know if it was about 50 or 60 years ago, the conventional thinking was that as we aged, the arteries stiffened and got harder, so your blood pressure should be high to force the blood through the arteries. So the sum was, you'd be allowed 100 plus your age. That's what your blood pressure could be at the top number.
Oh, it would change.
Yeah, so if you're 65, it's 165. If you're 66, it's 166. Wow. And they said, yeah, it's no problem even if it gets to 200. And you're like, what? Yeah. That's what the current level of thinking was then.
Wow.
And I found that quite interesting to read. But yeah, the best reading is 110 over 75.
And can you explain how exactly exercise lowers your blood pressure? Because in theory, like in my mind, I'm like, well, you're working harder. Surely it would be more.
It increases nitric oxide.
Right.
Which dilates the blood vessels and helps lower blood pressure.
Because you've got me, a handicap.
You want to, because caffeine does spike the blood pressure. So you want to, we want, what we want to see with you, Jamie, is we want to level it all out. So we want to limit the sodium, limit the caffeine, and see where the blood pressure truly lies. That's what we want to see.
Yeah.
And then I'll give you beetroot juice.
Yeah.
You know, a great study in the British Heart Foundation with the BHF that shows that beetroot juice is as effective as some of the beta blockers in reducing blood pressure because it increases nitric oxide.
Yeah. Wow.
It does say that, literally, because I have a beetroot concentrate, which I have a shot. And before exercise, so
but if you can't,
I'm used to it now. When
you told me you didn't know it was a concentrate.
Oh right, yeah. So the first time Steph got me, you said I should take I think it was 70 or 700 milliliters, and she bought me the concentrated version. So I drank the whole bottle of concentrate. So hopefully it was lower that then. You know what I mean?
It was like that. Super chill.
Yeah. Well, no, I've just got the shots at the moment. But yeah, that, and then the last one is HIIT training.
HIIT training is very good because, like I said, it increases the nitric oxide
in an acute space of time.
Yeah. So you'll see the blood pressure decrease as it goes on. But also, you know, just the I think it's the changes of the hormones response as well. Obviously, you've got catecholamines being released. And the kind of the neural response to that as well, but it's mainly through NO, nitric oxide.
And so when someone is a regular exerciser, is their blood pressure better because of the actual exercise, or is it the overall impact on their body of like
overall impact? So it's both. So the exercise will help, and the overall benefit of training. As well, and overall benefit of training, and the overall benefit of the adaptations that's been made to the body because of the training.
Right.
So that's why you would see a response in decreasing the blood pressure.
Yeah.
So
why, and when we're looking at HIIT training, like what would be the specific protocol? Because for me and for us, we see a lot of clients who say, "Oh, I do HIIT training. I go to a HIIT class."
So
they actually do circuit training.
Yeah.
And it just gets wrapped up as a HIIT class, and I think a lot of people also get confused with, "Oh, if I went and jumped on, say, like a treadmill with a controlled speed." That's HIIT training. But like I was saying, when I used to sprint when I was younger, and we do, you couldn't do it on a treadmill because the speed's controlled. The whole point is you do 200 meters and you go flat out.
Yeah.
You rest 90 seconds, you go 200 meters again, you go flat out. And every time you decrease your speed, but you are going at your max.
That's what you want to be doing.
Yeah. And we would do four rounds of that and rest for half an hour.
I would suggest 40 to 60 seconds of absolutely hard, intense exercise, like you just said. So you sprint 40 to 60 seconds,
so you need to be doing something that you can control the speed.
So I would say, if you're going to do like, if I would, for me, I would mainly do my interval training on the treadmill.
Okay, how would you do that then if you're controlling the speed?
My latest protocol would be I'm going 18 kilometers sprint for 60 seconds, and then I'm 2 minute rest, active recovery day. It's not just
you're walking around.
That's just stuff.
So I'll go down to 10, just a small job. Let that glycogen resynthesis. Back to it 2 minutes later.
And how many times?
I did that. I got to 6 times.
Okay, so we're not saying do an hour long HIIT class.
No. HIIT is great because you can do it in a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. So that kind of like response, but that's what I would suggest, something like that.
And
you've got it bang on though, what you just said you're doing. Like nine, that would be the one I would advise you to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was 15 years ago.
Get on it, Jamie.
How I've done them in the past as well, I've done like a bike or an egg bike or something.
Yeah,
like
which
I
is perfect.
I can control the speed and I'll go flat out.
Controlling the variables, like you say, is the most important part, I think, of the interval trainers. Yeah, that's good.
And so that's something that if somebody's listening and they've always thought HIIT sounds horrendous, I don't want to do HIIT for a whole class. Actually, what you've just described is something they could maybe start with, like two rounds of 40 seconds and then build up three rounds, four rounds.
And we're seeing research that shows that that's even beneficial for the body as well, just like a couple of minutes of exercise.
We know it.
Oh, so there was that study recently, wasn't there, of the very high intensity bursts of exertion, and that had a significant effect on mortality risk.
But that's been backed up. That's been known for a while.
Yeah.
It's been backed up a couple of times.
It's also great for cognition. Like, people are going to think I'm weird for saying this, but like in the middle of the day, if I get like a bit of a drop in energy,
I'll
go downstairs and do like 40 burpees. I was just like, set to 10.
Oh, yeah. Do you know what? I actually really love it when Jim makes us do burpees on the team meet and I always get a real buzz.
Well, you're just, that's good. Yeah. It does make a big difference.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always kind of said at work in the lab, because I'm doing my research at the University of Leicester and I'm doing it on the, just so the viewers know that my research is in cardiovascular sciences and I'm looking at telomere length effect on vascular smooth muscle cells in atherosclerosis. That's my specific research.
Could you explain that to somebody who doesn't necessarily know all the background of those big words?
Yeah, sure. So, so in our cells, we have chromosomes. Everyone knows we've got chromosomes, right? That's where we store our DNA. And at the end of the chromosomes, you've got something called telomeres. These telomeres shorten every time. So what the telomeres actually do is two things. They help you replicate the full chromosome and they protect the chromosome from the DNA damage repair mechanisms of the cell by hiding the end parts of the strand.
Oh, so, and they're like toenails.
Sorry?
Are they like toenails?
They're like lasers.
But just, you know, like they stop you stubbing your toe.
So what they, but the problem is you can't fully replicate the telomere length. You lose about, you lose a bit of, like 80 base pairs. You lose every time the cell replicates, you lose some telomere length. As that gets shorter and shorter and shorter, it gets to something called the Hayflick limit. The Hayflick limit is where the cell goes, right, I've not got enough telomere length left, so I'm going to stop dividing and I'm going to go into a state of senescence. So it's called cellular senescence. And that is, the cell's still active, it's still metabolically active, but it's actually like, we call them zombie cells. So they're still metabolically active and they release like a SAS protocol, like an associated like phenotype problem. And they're releasing like molecules that are involved in inflammation and all sorts. They also make other cells around them senescent as well. So the more senescent cells get more senescent cells. And so that's how telomere length works. And for some reason, so the vascular smooth muscle cells are in the artery. And when you get atherosclerosis, they can activate and become problematic. And it's one of the main cells in atherosclerosis that we're trying to look at. And telomere length has, so we know short telomere length has an effect on vascular smooth muscle cells that is independent from cellular senescence. We just don't know why. And that's what I'm specifically looking at.
That's deep.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. Yeah. It's fun though. It's good. Yeah. It's good. Yeah.
So, with the outcome of that study, what would be the?
We're looking for druggable targets because telomere. So, if you've got short telomeres, because telomeres are, this is the thing, right? Telomere length cannot be changed, right? So you'll have like these.
So you're born with that, or like
that's exactly right, Jamie. Yeah. You inherit your telomere length.
Right.
And then the first 2 decades of life is where you see the most attrition of your telomeres because you're actively dividing. You know, you're growing. So you see a lot of attrition in telomere length in the first 2 decades of life. And then after that, your telomere length is fixed as you go throughout life. Benitos did a really good paper on this in 2013. Right. So no matter what someone's saying about extending your telomere length, you can't. And you don't want to anyway, because the other good thing about is cellular senescence is actually a mechanism to prevent cancer as well. Because if you've got really long, we know like cancer is associated with long telomere length because it keeps.
Because it's multiple growth of. It's like overgrowth of cells.
The cells just keep dividing, dividing. So, you know, you don't want to grow your telomere length. You really don't.
Yeah.
But you get cancer. Yeah. But you don't want to have short telomere length because you get cardiovascular disease. We know it's causal. We know it's causal now. So it's not just associated with it. There's loads of studies that have shown that, you know, telomere length is associated with cardiovascular disease. Now we know it causes cardiovascular disease. So you inherit short telomere length, and we know these people are going to get are a bigger risk for cardiovascular disease than people that have normal to long telomere length.
So it's another one of those genetic risk factors that you can't really do anything about.
So what would you say, like, if someone's listening and they're worried about cardiovascular disease or they've know it's hereditary in their family, like, where would you suggest people start?
Start with exercise, get your BMI under control, and get your lipids done by your doctor. They're the three things that I would recommend. And if you've got high cholesterol, don't be scared of statins. This is another problem that we've got going on. There's so many doctors out there now that are selling books. Like, I mean, the first books were done by people like Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, The Cholesterol Con, and then you've got Dr. Seema Lothar. We know for a fact that LDL causes heart disease. We know cardiovascular disease. We know it. We've done there's been plenty of Mendelian randomization studies where we use genetic variants as instrumental variables, and we can see the direct effect of what LDL is doing. And it's yeah. big data. It's proven without a shadow of a doubt. And then you've got these doctors that are muddying the water, saying this, that, and the other, and that might be costing lives. And that's a big, big problem. So go to on side effects as well, statins, right? So there's been trials with lots of people where they've gave half the group a placebo and the other half a statin, and they've said to both groups what the side effects are. And the big one for statins is muscle aches and pains. And guess what? They all had similar side effects.
Yeah.
Right? So statins are going to help save your life if you've got big problems. They're going to protect your arteries around your heart. If you've got any plaques there, they're going to harden them. They might reduce the volume of them, and they're going to prevent them building up.
And a big one as well is going to be taking your blood pressure. Because yes. I would say most people don't know their blood pressure.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, sorry. I'm glad you pulled me up on that, Jamie.
Yeah.
Because, that's what I said to you. So taking your blood pressure at least once a week is vitally important, because it's a silent killer. Most people don't know they've got it. By the time they get to the doctor and the doctor's gone, oh, okay, yeah, 135 over 85, it's all right. It's probably because you're seeing me. And they've got white coat syndrome. So the doctor lets them go, and unbeknown, they probably have got high blood pressure. But because they've got white coat syndrome, the doctor's kind of shot it off.
Yeah.
So get a blood pressure monitor.
But if you even do go to doctors with 135 over, and they, even if you said it's not white coat, like I do it all the time, they still go, it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad.
You've got to kind of be 150 over 90 for it to start going, ooh.
Well, they're looking at making sure that you're hemodynamically stable and... that you ain't got no other, that you're not going to have no issues. And then, they'll put you on a beta blocker or another type of, like, an ACE inhibitor or walkout, whatever they want to put you on. But, you should be doing something about that. You can start with beetroot juice. If you can't, if you don't get your BMI. So if you're overweight, you're not exercising, and your blood pressure's high, the first thing to do is get to a normal weight and exercise. If your blood pressure's still high, go to your doctor and get yourself on a medication.
Yeah. So would you say for a lot of people that taking action with exercising and then losing weight,
nutrition would exercise mean first,
they possibly wouldn't need their drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So plenty of people who worked with us and they've been on blood pressure medication, we took them off. Obviously, we have medical doctors that work with us, and they've just took them off the medication because they have normal blood pressure now, or low blood pressure because they were taking the blood pressure medication.
Yeah.
And that's actually something we see a lot with our clients, isn't it? That they will start with high blood pressure, and within a couple of months, they are out of that risk zone. But I think if you're on medication, sometimes it feels like, well, that's me now. But what you're saying is, no, if you make these lifestyle changes, you can come off that medication. It's not your trajectory for the rest of your life. No. Is that the case with statins?
It depends why you're taking the statin. So if you get your triglyceride, I think if you get your triglyceride, you can have your LDL, like I say, about 3, total cholesterol about 5, and if your triglycerides are normal, then you're probably okay. If you've not got a problem with apolipoprotein B and lipoprotein A and other atherogenic molecules, you probably don't. You might not need a statin.
Yeah.
But if you have them risk factors, you definitely need a statin.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So one thing that I was looking at when you stated the other day when we were chatting about the episode, that cardiovascular disease was the biggest killer in the US and the UK?
And the UK, yeah. So for men, cardiovascular disease is the biggest killer in the United Kingdom, absolutely, and the United States of America. However, for women, it's not in the UK. It's now Alzheimer's and dementia.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yep. Which I found really interesting.
And then it's cardiovascular disease, yeah.
Are there similar risk factors?
Alzheimer's is not my bag. I don't really know. I did do some research on Alzheimer's. Not research, I had some modules at university on Alzheimer's. I know basics about it. The risk factors for that, they can be similar, yeah, I suppose.
But is it for women? Women's lower risk because they've got smaller hearts?
Yeah, why is the risk? Because it's significantly higher for men. I've got a nice little graph, actually. I'll put it for you. but, like, this is the blokes and this is the women.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So, like, the blokes weigh up. Nice. like they should have their own chart. why is that? Because I've heard people go, oh, well, it's because men are more stressed.
Men are just, in terms of, like, the risk factors, men are more prone to cardiovascular diseases.
And is that a genetic thing? Okay. So the other thing with this graph is,
women have longer telomere length than men.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, why is that?
Maybe God wants you to live
longer. Because we live longer. We do live longer, don't
you we? You do live longer, yeah. You absolutely do live. You live a couple of years longer than men. So that's why my wife is 2 years older than me, so
yeah, we died at the same time. Out.
Yeah.
So the other reason I printed this graph off, which we'll get up, is this is actually the rate of mortality in 50 years from cardiovascular disease. It goes down.
Yeah, and it will go down because we're getting really good at treating it, but we don't. So the mortality might go down, but the morbidity will go up. So you've got two kind of like statistics that you want to look at. You want to look at both mortality and morbidity. So that means basically people are getting it still, but no, not dying from it.
Right.
We're getting very, very good at treating it. But what we want to do is get very, very good at preventing it. And you can. It's not hard. It's sort your weight. So your modifiable risk factors that you can go straight away. Blood pressure, lipids, weight, exercise, diet. Get them all sorted. See where your lipids are at. See where your blood pressure is at. If they're all good, I would imagine that your risk factors are low.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was really perplexed why, you know, over that period of time, people's diets have got worse, their exercise levels have gone down, obesity's gone up. But you're saying it's because we are actually also better at science.
Yeah, we're far better.
We have medicine.
The medicine. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it doesn't mean that the problem's getting less.
No, it's still a bit of a problem.
Just a bit.
Yeah. So still a bit of a problem.
Yeah. Actually, one of the stats I found was someone dies every 33 seconds in the US from cardiovascular disease. Probably. It's a pretty big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And people, and this is the issue, like I said to you, they're willfully ignorant of it. You know that you're getting heart disease. You know where the risks are and you willfully ignore it, thinking medicine will save you. But when you're 65 years old, you get a pain in your chest, you go clammy, you go pale, you have to sit down, you find it hard to breathe, you'll be thinking, I should have prevented that. I shouldn't be in this position.
And is there ever a point that it is too late? Like you've gone too
far?
No,
it's never. There's never too late. Obviously, you can do much better earlier, but it's not too late. Get yourself sorted. Get yourself to your doctor. Get your lipids checked. Get your blood pressure sorted. Get your weight right. Get your exercise in, and live better. Don't be one of these people that do die from heart disease
and regret it.
Well, I mean, you can't regret it. You're dead.
Well,
yeah, it's that part of it too. But no, there's a lot of people who also have either a heart attack or a stroke, and it vastly changes their life forever. Mm. And it's like they do wish at that point, I wish I'd have paid attention to this sooner and
absolutely,
and just not ignore it, because you do just bury your head sometimes. Yeah. It'll be fine.
But it's not. It's not fine. It's the biggest killer, and people are just willfully like.
I think that's the big one for me is being regularly doing blood pressure.
Yeah.
So like, it's just you can't ignore it. You know what I mean? You can just regularly take your blood pressure and you see if your numbers are up or not.
And you can do it yourself very easily.
And you can do
it's
it yourself.
Like as easy as getting on a scale, really.
Yeah, it takes a, what?
A minute.
Yeah, it doesn't take long to do your blood pressure at all. Yeah.
So I've got a case study question for you.
Okay.
So my brother was very overweight. He's probably like 130 kilos. He's lost 50 kilos.
Wow, good for him.
He now runs marathons for
fun. That's 80 kilos, so he's weighing 80 kilos.
He's about 70-something, yeah. He's like super fit now. He literally just went on Saturday. He's like, right, I'm just going to go out for a 4-hour run. See you later. I was like, okay, bye. but he is now like, well, I obviously spent my 20s and early 30s very overweight, causing these problems. Now I've got that all in check. Is this now like I'm okay now? Or is there like a time delay? Or
obviously, like, because he was overweight and living poorly in his 20s and his 30s, that's going to have caused some issues. Absolutely. But is that going to catch up with him? I think he's probably got to his 40s, gone, right, I need to get healthier, sorted out his risk factors. That's done him really, you know, that will have a positive effect decreasing his risk.
And is it instant? Because you know they used to say, like, if you give up smoking, you get like this much increase in or decrease in 1 year, then this much in 7 years. Like, is there a same kind of thing?
Nah, I don't think we've done. No, I mean, we know his risk will be decreased because if his lipids are better. Even now, even at 40 years old, if his lipids are better, if his LDL is good, if his BMI is good, and he stays that way, he's gonna reduce his. I can't give you an exact.
Yeah.
An exact figure of saying if he stays that way for 10 years, it's going to reduce his risk by this much. We just know that.
So what's the damage that you can do then prior to that?
Yeah, you can build up atherosclerosis. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so that could be there and it's there now for good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can reduce it through use of statin therapy.
But not just through exercise and diet.
I don't think so. No. Okay. I think what you need to do is get him to have a stress echocardiogram.
So you were saying about me doing this like once a year.
I love stress echocardiograms. Yeah. Because what you find, and the earlier you can do it, the better, what you'll find is there's any inducible arrhythmias. So you've got to remember the heart's like an electrical circuit board as well. So it's beating to an electrical pulse, if you like. And you'll have on the stress echo, you'll have an electrophysiologist there, a cardiac doctor that specializes in electrophysiology. They're known as EPs. And they'll take you, and I always suggest don't do the chemically induced stress echocardiogram, do the treadmill one or the cycle one.
Yeah.
It gets your heart rate up to 95% to 100%, and it will induce an arrhythmia if that arrhythmia is there. It might induce the arrhythmia. It can spot that. And also what you'll then do is you'll go into the ultrasound and you'll get your heart visualized, you'll be able to see if there's any inducible ischemia, which is restriction of blood flow around the heart, and you'll be able to check the chambers to see, make sure they're okay, the wall size, make sure you've not got no left ventricular hypertrophy, make sure the mitral valve and all the other valves are working well, nice. Mm-hmm. A very, very good test, and I do it once a year.
So it sounds quite in depth, and in the UK, obviously, the NHS probably aren't going to pay for that.
They're not.
Nope. So if you were to go private, how much are we talking?
It's about £650.
Okay. And in the US, would that be covered by insurance, or is it more seen as like a nice to
You can do it. I don't know of the cost. It's probably going to be more expensive because of the US healthcare.
Yeah.
It's terrible, isn't it? Yeah. Insurance definitely covers it.
Okay.
Mm. Yeah, so I would probably go for your insurance carrier.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay.
Good to know. The other thing, like you mentioned earlier about caffeine.
Yes.
Is there anything else that's not like specifically diet and exercise in the broad sense, but like things like caffeine that you can make a really simple change?
Sodium, reduce your salt intake.
Yeah. Salt, okay. Yeah.
So try and go to about 1 to 1.5 grams a day rather than the 2 that they're giving you.
So I would say like most people probably don't even know how much salt
they're having. Yeah. So the best way to... And I know it's not the best way, but is to actually read the labels and calculate how much salt that you have in.
Food, yeah. A lot of our clients will already have done that if they've tracked the food on MyFitnessPal.
Yeah, they'll give you the salt on that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So have a look and see what it is. Mm. If that's what, I mean, if your blood pressure is already good, then you don't really need to worry about your sodium. But if your blood pressure is poor, then you probably do need to worry about your sodium.
Yeah, so 1.5 grams would be a goal to aim for.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's another reason, you know, we say track your food to understand what's in your food. It's not necessarily about your calories all the time.
It's to make
so,
sure.
So, yeah, I mean, tracking your food, make sure every single thing you eat is tracked. But just to then see for 3-4 days, like, what's my average will give you a bit of insight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
exactly.
Then you can make some tweaks.
Yeah.
Obviously, we always advocate to have, like, an 80% whole food diet, which means you're in a lot more control then of how much salt.
Sodium you are getting, yeah.
Because if you're having a lot of processed food, they put salt in because it makes it taste good, right? So,
well, salt was a preservative, so it was vitally important for how we've got to where we are today. We needed salt to preserve food so we could eat it later, and that's helped build a civilization.
So, for anyone who's listening, though, they could go, well, Jamie's healthy BMI, healthy weight, sleeps okay, does all the things that we've just mentioned, but I've still got high blood pressure. So, what do you think would be the reasons that stress.
And if it is stress, I do find this frustrating, because you'll go to the doctor, or you'll go to the person that you're seeing about your health and fitness, and say, just chill, relax, take some time. You can't run away from some stress. It's there. Mm. So in your instance, if you can't get your blood pressure under control, I would say let's get you to a doctor and let's get you on a beta blocker. You don't have to take it every day. Take it. We've got doctors that give it, say, every second day, every third day.
Yeah.
You know?
But there's also a lot you can try before then.
Absolutely. So you should always use medicine as the last kind of preventative tool.
I think a lot of people use it as the first.
Yeah, they do.
Because it's the easier route, isn't it? It's like, oh, make all these changes to my lifestyle and diet. Really difficult. Take a medication.
But look, what we're doing with you. Sodium, caffeine, exercise, get that sorted. I'm not saying that you don't exercise. I'm just saying this specific exercise. And then if that doesn't work, we'll try some other stuff. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work, then we'll go to to the medication. And that's how it should work. Unless like you've got one of these risk factors such as lipoprotein A, which I think you should be on a statin. Yeah.
And so is that the order in which there's the biggest impact? So sort the sodium first and then the caffeine, because they've got like the biggest effect?
No, I mean, I think sodium does. Like, there's people out there that said sodium don't, but again, we've got big meta-analysis that show that salt does cause issues with blood pressure. And if you take it out, like if you say reduce it by 1 gram a week, you see, you know, blood pressure goes down. And that's just on big data. It's not on you know, it's not on small data. Caffeine will just spike the blood pressure. We don't want to be seeing that.
So what's a okay amount of caffeine? Because this is also my brother the other day. He made, on my coffee machine, you can press one cup, the little picture, which is one espresso shot, or two cup. He pressed two cup twice in one mug, and then he had another one like 10 minutes later.
I'm sure he's running well with that amount of caffeine, isn't it?
I was like, what are you doing? But it's like, he literally said, well, I've just run 26 miles, it's fine. And I was like, I don't think
he just ran it or was about to?
He just ran it.
Oh, right.
I was like, I don't really think that's before, how it works.
I don't really know that the answer to that question. I drink decaf. Everything's decaf. I've not drank I've not had caffeinated beverages since 2016.
Oh, wow. So, because of your risk factors already?
Yeah, my risk factor. I'm not sure to answer, to be perfectly honest. I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah.
I just say limit caffeine.
Yeah. If you are in a risk population.
Yeah, if you're in a risky population. Yeah. But so, if your blood pressure is high, you want to limit caffeine. Yeah. You don't want that being... It's not going to chronically elevate it all the time, but it's going to possibly spike it. And then you don't want that.
Mm-hmm. And how about sleep? As well, like how
sleep is vital.
Yeah,
absolutely vital. I think you should be getting between. I mean, I sleep about 6.5 hours a night. That's my worst problem.
Yeah,
I think you should get 7 to 9 hours, depending on.
That's rhythm. All the research points towards 7 to 9 hours, doesn't it?
Good. Yeah,
but it also helps regulate all those other things like your stress
and appetite.
Yeah, and then whether you're going to be bothered to get up and do a workout in the
motivation
morning
to even work out.
Yeah.
And have you got any favourite protocols for the stress management that you would recommend to people?
This is the thing, is like I don't, when it comes to stress, I think it, because of the where we live, what we're doing, how we have to work, it's very, very hard to avoid stress. So I say to people, exercise, of course, because exercise can be a big benefit to people that undergo a lot of stress. I can say things like take your time out, but it's whether that person can take the time out.
Yeah.
Stress is unavoidable. So
that's how you react to it. You can learn to react differently.
And this is the great thing about exercise. Exercising, good exercise, will help you react better in stressful situations.
Oh, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd be more resilient for sure.
You are more resilient. Mm-hmm. So I think exercise, again, is one of the most important things for your body.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
And I do think there are lots of techniques you can learn in terms of like time management. If somebody constantly feels stressed because their life is chaotic, there's lots of things you can do to learn how to feel less stressed by the same environment and by the same lifestyle. So that's definitely a big thing we focus on with our clients, isn't it?
Just
helping them feel more in control, because a lot of stress is feeling like life is happening to you and you have no control over it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you start to be the driver in your life, the stress does feel less.
It feels manageable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So that would be your general advice then. If somebody is in a risk factor, you've got sodium, caffeine, exercise, sleep, and manage your stress.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just to reduce your overall risk of cardiovascular disease. So to summarize that, I would say get yourself into a healthy weight, exercise, get your lipids checked and right. Make sure
that's as simple as a blood test.
Yeah, and that's just a blood test. Get your blood pressure sorted. Then what I would
do... And take your blood pressure every week.
And take your blood pressure every week.
Yeah, yeah.
Very important. And then what I would do, if they're in a risk factor, if they've got risks there, like the lipoprotein A, you need to get to the doctor, get yourself on a statin. Listen to the doctor's advice on that. If you've got...
Doctors have generally advised that, if that's the case.
Sorry?
Will doctors advise
that? Yeah, they
will,
yeah. They'll know of the... Don't know of the new treatments for lipoprotein A and all the atherogenics. And then if they're in a risk factor for, say, blood pressure, that's when you'd want to reduce sodium and caffeine. So okay. If your blood pressure is elevated, then you are at a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Let's start to work on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's been hugely insightful, Callum. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Have you got any other burning questions?
I mean, so I'm doing this protocol with you now, aren't I, for a month. Yeah. Or, I mean, we're going into month two of trying to get it down. Is that like, so my numbers are like 140 over 80. What would you say just for anyone who's listening? They do a blood pressure. Like how many times would they want to check and over how many days? And what would be like a bad number for them to be looking out for?
So, I mean, for the blood pressure, I think the best protocol is to take it three times and take the average.
Yeah,
wait. As in three separate days?
No,
three
times on that instance. Take it three times, 60 seconds in between each time. Take the average of that. If it's elevated, if it's over 120 over 80, then it's elevated. If it gets to 130 over 85, that's when you should start to think about actin. That would be the specific number, 130 over 85.
I'd say a lot of people are probably out there.
Absolutely are, Jamie. Yeah.
Yeah. It's I know, just look for that on the average as well. I would take it sometimes and get like 147 over 80. And then I would just literally do some breathing. And within the next time I take it, like a minute later, it could be like 127 over 80.
Right,
so yeah. It could drop quite a lot. And that's why the three times is good and taking the average, because even though you got that high reading, sometimes it is good to do some like breathing exercises before, right? And actually just try and calm yourself down.
Yeah, just sit down. I mean, I think you should take it first thing, well, half an hour after waking up in the morning, allow that adrenaline to kind of cortisol to come down a little bit, and sit there and then take three readings, take the average. If it's 130 over 85, then start thinking about doing something.
Yeah.
Nice. So if anyone wants to find out more about your work, where can they find you on the internet?
So I've got a company called GC Biosciences, and we do testing, of course, and we help people, we help men reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease. That's like what we mainly do.
Yeah.
Because men are at more risk of it, not because we don't like women.
Just to be clear.
A load of comments in a section. Yeah.
And is there an Instagram for that?
Sorry?
Is there an Instagram?
Yeah, there's an Instagram for GC Biosciences, and we've just redesigned the website, so that'll be up by the time this comes out. I've also started, I'm involved in another business called Legacy Performance. It's where we look after athletes and we do performance testing in the athletes as well. That's a new little endeavor of mine. Not that I've not worked with athletes before, I have, and I've done blood tests for athletes and got them to low risks and for diseases and better performance. Because when you're working with that top population, the athletes, you need they're looking for every 0.5% more performance just to drive them past that finish line. And what we do at Legacy is we look at MMA athletes and jiu-jitsu athletes, and we're working with the top guys in that field and helping them.
Super interesting.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of your fascinating knowledge.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Do I keep the heart?
I don't know.
You can if you want, yeah.
Ever wondered why losing weight seems so hard after you hit 30? You're not alone. At Body Smart, we specialise in helping women like you over the age of 30 to lose 30 to 60 pounds in less than 6 months. Guaranteed. And that's without restrictive diets or endless hours in the gym. Our approach works because it's delivered through customized, direct, one-on-one coaching. Your coach will tailor a fully personalized plan that fits into your life, focusing on sustainable habits, not temporary fixes. On average, our clients lose 5 to 10 pounds a month, and that's not an outlier. That's what you can expect to achieve month in, month out. And yes, these results are guaranteed. Ready to see for yourself? Visit bodysmartfitness.com to apply. Remember, we're here exclusively for women over 30 who are serious about taking charge of their health. Apply at bodysmartfitness.com.